from the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing. This is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the September 2015 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. We meet again. I join you from the Visitor Centre in Block C on the morning of the annual Veterans Reunion with podcast producer Mark Cotton as we wait for the veterans to start arriving. After a whole summer of 70th anniversary commemorations, it's time for people who worked in secret here and at Bletchley Park's outstations to remember their contribution. As ever, the stars of this show are the veterans themselves, and we'll listen in as they soak up the atmosphere back in the very buildings where they did their vital war work and reminisce with each other. There's unprecedented media interest in this year's reunion too, so by the time you're hearing this, you may well have seen, heard or read some of the veterans' stories in the news over the last few days. The reunion rounds off the summer at Bletchley Park, but autumn has plenty going on as well. Coming soon, we've got Bletchley Park Presents Tessa Dunlop on the 16th of September. The award-winning author and broadcaster will talk about her extraordinary journey through the life stories of 15 women with a shared experience. 70 years ago, they worked for the top-secret Government Code and Cipher School. On the 18th of October, Bletchley Park presents Gordon Carrera, the BBC's security correspondent, will give a talk on his book, Intercept, The Secret History of Computers and Spies, From Bletchley Park to Modern Cyber Espionage. And on the 17th of October, the 1940s boutique opens once again for a whole day of vintage glamour. Learn how to create that iconic 1940s look for yourself. Meanwhile, the veterans are starting to arrive to spend the day steeped in memories, and we're off to join them.
Good morning, veterans. Good morning. Are we all sitting comfortably? Wonderful. If you can see the camera, then you'll be in the picture. So I'm going to take a few, and I'll give you the nod when I'm going to do it, okay?
Just wait for one more.
Still one more.
He's on the way up now.
We're waiting for one more of your colleagues. Does anybody know any songs? Choose a song, have a sing. Okay, 3, 2, 1, smile. Just going to check those, have a little look-see, bear with. That's brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. Enjoy your day.
I'm Margaret. Margaret Thomas.
Margaret, you were a Wren.
I was.
And you were at Bletchley Park. What was the start of that for you? Did you join up? Were you called up?
No, I was called up. I had the choice of going into munitions or going into the Wrens. So, of course, that was a no-brainer. I went out to London and had one or two interviews. And I told them that I did lots of chess. I played lots of chess. And I think that sealed my fate.
Had someone told you to say that? Or
No. I was just asked what my interests were. And I couldn't think of anything else except I used to play with my Uncle John for hours on end. But,
oh, really?
Yes, so that's how that came out. Anyway, the next thing I knew, I was sent up to Tully Hewan, which was in Scotland, and we had the sort of inaugural. And that was the day before Christmas, the 24th of December. And it was very cold and quite exciting, really, but it was very, very dark. Eventually, we were sent down here to Station X, it was called in those days. We were sent down to Bletchley Station, and we were taken... I think we went to Owen Abbey that night, whereas where I lived. Mm. It sounds very grand, but actually...
It wasn't, was it?
No, it wasn't.
It was awful.
It was up in the servants' quarters, where it was cold, but... It was quite fun, really. You know, we used to sort of chase around the big, long corridors because the loo was miles away. Yeah. It was before they got all the ablutions in, probably. And we used to dash along. There was supposed to be a ghost up there. So we used to tease each other, and ghost is coming, and off we'd go.
Was this the first time you'd been away from home?
No, I'd been away from home for a couple of years previously because I'd been evacuated.
Oh, had you?
Yes, to Crawley, which was just a little tiny village then. It wasn't, you know, so being away from home was no real problem at all.
Because a lot of the ladies will say to me, you know, yeah, it was the first time they'd been away from home. It was like a new adventure for them. You know?
Well, it was a new adventure, but it wasn't all that
grand.
New to me, no, a grand, so, yes, and then we came here, I think, and I had some tall friends, and they were about 5'6" or 5'7", and they were put on the bomb machines, and I was only 5'2" or 5'3", so I had to do all the, oh, and it was so boring, the, you know, the messages used to come in. And we used to have to type them on this machine and it would go off somewhere. We knew not where. We never saw them again or what the result was. I know far more about it now than I did then.
So were you testing the settings after the bomb operator?
I don't know. It might have been. It might not have been. I really, really don't know. All I know is that we settled down on these sheets of 5 letters and just typed them in the machine. On and on.
Were these the original intercepts? So
I think they probably were.
Were you on a teleprinter?
I don't know. It was a very big machine. That's bigger than the ones we see here.
I think it was a teleprinter.
Yeah.
Were they the handwritten ones?
No, they weren't. They were typed. I suppose they'd come in typed.
So they came in on type. Try and work out what you did.
Well, when you found that, do let me know.
You. I mean, how was it actually working here? Were you on shifts?
Yes, we were. We were 3 shifts, you know, a night shift. And it got quite depressing in the end. The weather was very cold. There was not a lot to do. There was very little social life because we were gathered up after our stint into these buses and taken back to Bletchley Park.
Yes. It was a bit different for some of the ladies who were actually billeted in Bletchley.
Yes, they must have had a lot of fun.
They could get on the train and
jump down to
London, couldn't they?
We used to have 2 or 3 days off. And then my friends and I, we used to do a bit of hitchhiking then. And one time we went right across to her house, which was miles away. And other times we did it to my house, which was only sort of more or less down the road because I was living in Pinner. Yes, so that was quite easy. And when the war was over, we were all at the front there. We were taken outside, you know, the big, big announcement that was going to be made. And then they said, oh, the war with Germany is over. Great cheers. And all the German people sort of cheered like anything. But we were on the Japanese one. Our faces drooped a bit, I think. And we toddled off back to work. So it was a bit of a...
And where were you working then? What?
Hut 7 then.
Hut 7, yes.
Yes. And there I stayed until they dropped the atom bombs. And then after that, that was over for us, so that we were demobbed. It had its moments, and it was quite interesting from some points of view.
Looking back, have you got fond memories? I mean, obviously, you know, the cold nights,
yes,
they weren't great, but
some of them
were.
Yes, some of them are very fond memories. I had a great friend called Ruth who met a Canadian and went to live in Canada. So instead of us being together, we were here together the whole war, sleeping in the same cabin, sitting next to each other doing this typing stuff. She went off to Canada with her new husband and I went back home. And it was really rather horrible then because all my other friends from where I was at home, they were all scattered as well.
Yeah.
So it was just a question then of picking up a life, making a new life, getting married, having children.
So many people find it hard to believe that all of you kept the secret for so long, but they don't realise that that was such an all-encompassing time in your lives.
Yes.
You were very young,
and
you wanted to start your real lives, really, because they were on hold, weren't they?
I can remember looking out. I don't think we could see through the window, but here I'm lulling my life away here. I want to go and get on with it and have babies and,
And actually start your adult life, wasn't it, really?
So eventually that's what we did. But, yes.
And so for you, was it when the Winterbottom book came out? Was the first you knew of anyone talking about it, or was it later?
I think I read about it somewhere.
Winterbottom wrote the first book.
Was it?
Winterbottom, yes. In 74.
And
that's the book that most of our veterans will go,
yes.
Oh, I can't believe he did that.
It was a terrible thing to do after we kept our lips so tight.
When was it when you first started speaking about what you'd done? Was it quite late on?
Well, oh, yes. It wasn't until, well, even after he'd given it away. There was no one to talk to about it. You know, what could you say? I worked at Bletchley Park. Oh, did you? You know, that sort of thing.
I think that's the thing, because it was so compartmentalised here.
Yes.
None of you realised how important your little bit was.
No, I wish we had known a bit more, but it's not until sort of quite recently that I'm a very important person, I'm told.
You all are very, very important.
Yes.
We always say the same thing. Everyone was a cog in this big machine.
That's right.
And without you, the next person couldn't
that's
do their
true.
Work.
Yes.
And the person before you, you couldn't have done your work.
And we were saving lives in a way. Well, it was a piece in the paper that I read afterwards and how the Germans were trying to make the atom bomb and all this stuff was going through our machines. Now, I didn't know that at the time, but if they had got uranium, they'd have made the atom bomb. And this man who was talking about it said, do you think you would have used it? And this German chap said, I'm sure we would. What do you think? So I knew then what I'd done a bit more.
Do you look back? Are you proud of what you did?
I suppose in a way I am now more, yes. When people say, oh, no, that was good, and people shake your hand and think.
But you're all so modest about it, aren't you?
I don't know, but there's nothing to be grand about, you know.
That's what I love about all of our veterans.
Mm-hmm.
You're all, oh, well, I didn't do anything
that
important.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I didn't.
But, you know, the freedoms that we all have now are really down to you people.
Yes.
We're all here thanks to people like you. So can I just say thank you for your service?
Thank you. That's kind of you. Very kind.
No, Japanese. I didn't know it was Japanese until I saw it during the book. Probably didn't know what we were doing. I mean, there was no idea of what we were doing.
I'm sat here with Dennis Underwood at the moment. Dennis, can you tell us what you did during World War II?
Well, initially, trained in the Isle of Man at the Royal Signal Special Operator Training Battalion. And having finished there, went to Rothamsted Manor at Harpenden for a brief period.
And what year was this?
1944, then, when I got there.
How old were you then?
19.
Young whippersnapper?
Yes. A shy young whippersnapper.
You should see the smile on his face now, listeners.
And then was posted out to, initially India, to Abbottabad on the northwest frontier, now Pakistan. Still a military base, had been a British Army base, I think, from way, way back. It had been a signals intelligence place from, I believe, the mid-1920s. So we were there for a short period. The funny thing is, I can remember bits and pieces of there. I can remember the equivalent to a naffy where an Indian came round with his cha for tea. I have no recollection of the work we did there, believe it or not. We must have done some, but I've no recollection. I can recollect the barracks, which were clearly Victorian, large, airy ones, with a fireplace at either end. And as we were there, it was sort of winter time. You needed the fireplace at night. We had a bearer who used to look after us, wake us up in the morning with tea, shave us in bed.
Really?
And I think we only paid about a rupee or 2 rupees a week. But that was enough for him to employ an assistant. His family had been doing this for years, of course.
To go from war-torn England to go out to India and all of a sudden you've got a chap shaving you in the morning.
Yes. It was like going back in time, really. We weren't there very long, though, and then travelled across India by train to Camilla on the east. It's now in Bangladesh, of course. And then from there we flew into Manipur in Burma, where I joined the C Indian Special Wireless Group. We were under canvas praying that the monsoons didn't start too soon because the tents were very worn and threadbare.
I don't think it would have mattered if they'd been brand new with a monsoon, would it?
Well, it probably kept it off us. Doing what we did, you were either on duty or you were not.
Did you do like a shift system? Or
shift system, yes.
It was quite regimented even out in the field then?
Oh yeah, yes. There were basically 5-hour shifts. The worst one was coming on at 3 a.m. to 8 a.m. But 5 hours was enough, given the temperature, the sweat and everything. And you worked through the 24 hours. So it was one shift, two shifts off. We went swimming in the Chinwin River then, which was low, pre-monsoon season. Almost like a seaside, the sandy beaches at the side of the river, and a sunken riverboat. I don't know whether the Japs had sunk it or we had, but we used to dive off that into the river. And we used to take our dhobi and washing down there, where the local lads would wash it for probably 40 cigarettes. And initially I sort of wondered and thought, do you reckon it'll be there when we come back? But yeah, it was.
Yeah.
No problem, beautifully clean, done. There's one interesting episode where a pilot had landed a Dakota on what was the strip for the light aircraft. The problem was getting it off, so they had to cut a few trees down.
Extend the runway.
They got volunteers from our unit to sort of hold the thing back. They stripped everything out of the plane except enough fuel to get it to the airstrip. It was only a 2-minute flight away.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. And he got off safely, the pilot. I think the one who landed it was told, you'll fly down.
Yeah, you landed it, you can get it back up.
So that was a little bit of interest. From there, we moved down by air again to Mike Tiller in central Burma, which had been a big Japanese centre in all ways, communication-wise, road-wise, rail-wise, and so on. And the fighting had been pretty desperate, I think. It had churned up the snakes so that they were roaming around rather homeless. Been not at all unusual to come. We were under canvas there. Come back to your bed, your charpoy, and find you got a snake curled up on it. But they were more frightened of us. There were lots about, but I don't know of anyone who ever got bitten. We carried on doing the intercept work there.
What were you actually intercepting? Was it Morse?
Morse, yes. It's the basic Morse code, plus they had lots of additions. Not a problem in reading it, really. We were doing lower-level traffic, basically, and quite a lot was purely numerical. But they used shortened letters. One was A, the equivalent to A, and two was U, and so on. So,
right.
So you get through it much more quickly. That's the sort of stuff we were intercepting until the war finished out there. From there, we went by road down to Rangoon. The war hadn't ended then. We'd got to Rangoon just about when the war in Europe finished.
And that must have felt, I mean, you know, back in Europe, the war was over and Slim's army were forgotten, really, in a way.
People thought that the war was over. Yeah, I mean, we basically said, well, so what? Might mean we get a bit more equipment now and perhaps a few more men. Although, of course, the 14th Army was the biggest army ever. It averaged 600,000 strong. Lots of lines of communication stuff, of course. And I think the total throughput to the army was about 1 million people that passed through it. But Bill Slim, he was, it'd be true to say, really, he was about loved by the troops, the fighting troops. Be right up front. Not that we were.
And it was a huge army. Something like 14 languages were spoken.
Well, the British troops were in the minority, very much so. I did count. I think there were about 12 Indian divisions, some West African and some East African divisions as well. And then there were all the specialist units. So it was huge. Being with the Indian unit, all Hindus pretty well, that's when I really got to know India and Indians. And the time I spent in India itself, I enjoyed. I enjoyed working with them. They worked well. And I've always been friendly with the ones that are here in this country as well.
Were you being supplied by Dakota constantly?
Until we got to Rangoon, basically, yes. In fact, off duty, we had the opportunity occasionally to go on one of the drops to units that were more isolated than we were. So you'd push the stuff out and hope it didn't fall on anybody.
Are they fond memories for you, or are they, you know, bittersweet? No,
they are really, I think, quite fond memories. Lots of friends. We did have fun. We were lucky. I mean, we were not a fighting unit, so they were the ones who suffered. Well, when the Japanese gave up, finished slowly, because a lot of isolated units wouldn't believe that the Emperor had given in, but eventually they did. We didn't give up intercept. When the last of the Japanese stations packed up, we moved to, well, we'd already been doing some Chinese army work. When the released prisoners began coming back, I suppose because we were already cleared for security doing what we did, we spent some time working in Rangoon University, coordinating the reports from returned prisoners about the treatment they'd had from the Japanese.
So probably, I guess you were collecting that for the war crimes trials, weren't you?
Yes.
Did you stay in the army, or were you demobbed?
No, I was lucky. I came up in a draw for leave at home, a month at home. As usual, that meant spending about a fortnight in a transit camp in Rangoon, waiting for a ship. Then the time it took for the ship to get to Southampton, and then home for a month. I'd been working as a civilian clerk in the local police force, where the office clerk had been called up, and I sort of took over his work. And I called to see everybody, visit the chief constable, and he said, "Oh, you're back, lad, are you?" "Yes." "When are you joining then?" I said, "No, I've got to go back." He said, "That's ridiculous." So he got in touch with the War Office, and about 2 days before I was due to travel to Southampton to go back, I got a telegram saying, "Report up to near Thirsk for Class B demob." So I never got back. In a way, I'm rather sorry, because they moved then to... Some went to Singapore, some went to Hong Kong, and I'd left my very good badminton racket hanging on the wall. That was lost. So that pretty well was the end for me. I came back and joined the police force. I'm still in touch with one, at any rate, of the friends I knew out there. The others have all died.
That's the thing. I mean, it's nice to get to interview a gentleman today. So many of the ladies have lasted longer than the gentleman, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I might not be here next year.
You look very spry to me, Dennis.
Well, I feel it, yes.
Well, I'd just like to thank you for your service. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Man with lots of slips of paper, with groups of... I was trying to remember, actually. Groups of letters all the way across. The whole thing was groups of four or five letters. The whole complete slip. And then we had a code thing that we had to work out on, which was so many down, so many up, so many across, so many...
Didn't leave school till I was 17 and a half, and then I was advised to take the civil service exam, and I think I might have done quite well, because I went into the Foreign Office. I was called up to Mayfair House in Park Lane, and I was interviewed by a lady called Miss Moore. She talked to me for some time, questioned me about what I liked, what were my hobbies, what I intended to do, all sorts of things like that. And after the interview, she said, "Thank you very much." And with that, she opened a drawer beside her and she took out a travel warrant. She said, "Here's a travel warrant. I want you to go home, pack a case immediately, tell no one, only your mother. And then I want you to go immediately to Euston Station, take the first train to Bletchley. And you will be met at Bletchley." That's how I arrived here. It's also strange. I had no idea I arrived in this very block. Right at the bottom, cold, miserable, dark, no heating.
Obviously, you would have had the blackout up still, wouldn't you?
It was pitch dark in here, and of course the machines, lots and lots of machines, which were mainly at this end of the block, they produced the warmth, really. Apart from that, it was a miserable, miserable place, and it was Christmas Eve when I arrived.
So, Christmas Eve, you had to go home and tell your mum that you were leaving.
Packed a case. Say to my mother, "I've got to go up to Euston Station." She, "What for?" I said, "I don't know." I couldn't tell her anything. She just knew I'd arrived in Bletchley. She wasn't allowed to come up and see me. I did have an auntie come up to see me. She got off the train at Bletchley. They met her, and she was taken to the other side of the station and sent home immediately. We never thought anything of it, though, you know. We weren't allowed to use public transport. they used to bus us into work, and they used to drop us right outside our billets, wherever we were billeted. My husband was here as well, but he's not well enough to be here with me today. But he was an engineer. His firm was the firm that built the bomb machine.
British Tabulation.
Tabulation Company, yes, which later became IBM. And so he was loaned by his firm to come here.
So was he working on maintenance on the Hollerith machines and things?
Yes. He was only in this block. There were two engineers on our shift. We had five shifts. They covered a period of 5 weeks. 2 weeks of 9 till 4, 1 week of 4 till midnight, and then another week of midnight till 7 in the morning, and then another week of 9 to 4.
That was a week, I'm guessing. 7 days, was it?
Yes. Yeah. And no leave. We weren't allowed leave unless we had something very good happen. And then we were given 48 hours leave.
So what was your general day-to-day work then?
Well, it's split into three groups, really. The first 18 months, I was in the machine room, and I was dealing with German naval and Japanese air signs. After 18 months, I was moved to a different area, and I was teaching wrens. I had 10 wrens at a time. I would have them for 3 weeks, and I would teach them how to use all the accounting machines, or as they were originally accounting machines, but they had been made into decoding machines. So after I had them for 3 weeks, they would then be transported to Alexandria to carry on the work. I enjoyed that very much, actually. From then, they put me into a little room, which is still in this block, and I was the only one allowed to use this machine, which was called the Eins machine. I loved that. I did that until 1945. It was a machine which consisted of four large wheels and then four more wheels, and I would set the first machine, give it a reading, start it off, then the next one, then the next one, and the next one, so that I would end up with all the wheels going round, stopping at intervals. And I used to have to take a reading every 15 minutes, and I was looking for a full stop. And when I found a full stop, the message would be relayed to Churchill. So it was an important job.
It's nice to hear from you, because it's telling us the story of what happened in here, in Block C.
We were called Hut 7 first, and then we became Block C. But everything took place in here. As I say, I met my husband here.
So did this engineer take a shine to a young lady?
Not first of all, no. No, I was telling my daughters. I arrived with one other girl. She was blonde, I was dark. And my husband was standing with another engineer quite a long way away. And apparently, this is only what he tells me, and he said to his colleague, "You can have the dark one, I'll have the blonde." And I happened to be the dark one, so he wasn't at all interested in me. But I suppose we were friends all the way through, and we didn't get together till about 2 years before the war ended. And we finally married in 1945, just as the Japanese war ended.
Now, you've come here today with two daughters?
Two. I've got three and a son, but the other daughter's been here before. When I came up to meet the Duchess of Cambridge, and she came with me in, but these are my middle daughter and my oldest daughter.
What do you think of what your mum did during the war?
We're very proud of what they did. I'm very proud of what my father did too. We didn't know really until about 15 years ago, this is what they did. They kept it completely secret. They never told anyone. So it's been fascinating finding out really what they did during the war, how important it was, and the fact that they met here, I think, is very special.
There's quite a few lovely stories of couples meeting here and still together now if they're both alive. It's so nice.
Couples. The only thing is, we were told we were not to fraternise with each other. No, no. Until we were found out. And Freddie Freeborn, who was in charge, he called us into his office and he said, "I hear you two are seeing each other." So we said, "Well, yes." He said, "Well, as you've behaved exemplary," he said, "I will allow you to continue."
As my sister said, we're very proud of our mum and dad, and we get a lot of our mathematical background, I think, especially from our dad. And this is fascinating coming up here. And they always told us to always tell the truth when we were little. And lo and behold, we found out that they didn't always tell us the truth.
I think the other thing's quite interesting, that both our parents are incredibly good at puzzles and crosswords, but and both of us are maths teachers. So I think that's been very helpful for us.
Everyone that was here was so proud to be here, especially when we got good news, you know. We did have some terrible news at times with the Atlantic crossing, where the USA used to send all this food for us. Of course, Hitler used to sink the ships before they even got here. And we used to have all that news coming in. My husband and I were on duty the night that they located the Scharnhorst. The next morning, in my billet, my landlady said to me, "You'll never believe it," she said. "The Scharnhorst has been sunk." I said, "Oh, has it really?" You know, we couldn't say anything. And because we'd sort of been involved in cracking the code, a week later, Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser, who was Admiral of the Fleet at the time and in charge of the battle, he sent for us. Those had been working on that. He told us the whole story, and it was such a different story to what was in the press. It was a terrible battle, apparently. We'd lost hundreds and hundreds of sailors. It was very bad. We captured the 101 submarine and the Enigma. It was the first one. It was eventually sunk, but the code books, my husband brought them into the park. He carried them in, and they were so interesting to look through, just to look at a German code book, you know. Huge, like ledgers. They were ledgers. That was momentous, because seeing my husband carry these code books, dripping with seawater.
Well, it's been absolutely wonderful to speak to you, Joan, and can I thank you for your service?
Very welcome. Very welcome. Thank you.
And I hope you have a wonderful day today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I was going to be in the country on holidays and knew that it was Veterans Day, and the chance to come and visit Bletchley Park was just an opportunity I couldn't not do, and the chance to maybe meet some veterans as well, sort of my version of celebrity. It started off just being a general interest in World War II, but then I got interested in sort of spies and code breaking, and it just sort of evolved from there, especially the female code breakers.
How did it feel coming here today?
It was amazing. It was felt really weird to be in a place that so much world-changing history has taken place, to actually be here where people like Alan Turing and Joan Clark have actually been, walked along the same paths of them, you know, looked at the same lake that they've looked at, and it was just quite surreal.
And there are parts of it you still feel like you're walking in the past as well, isn't there? You can almost transport yourself, can't you?
Yeah, a couple of times we just sat down and just sort of closed our eyes and just imagined what it would be like, you know, back then, apart from, you know, the whole there's a war going on and it's a bit scary, just the atmosphere. I was most excited about actually getting up to the mansion and having a look through there. Read so much about Bletchley Park already. I know quite a lot of the history of it. I actually just wanted to get in there and see it and look at the huts and look at the mansion and go for a walk around the grounds.
The library looks fantastic, the way they've laid it out, haven't they?
The library's fantastic. I would love to have a room like that in my house.
And somebody else who's come with you enjoyed that very much, didn't they?
Yes, my mum, who's travelling with me, she loves it. It was amazing. She made me take about 50,000 photos. Got to remember all of it. The whole house is just amazing. And it's sort of really scary that, you know, they were thinking of getting rid of the place before it got rescued. And when I read about it now, everything will be just that little bit more real, because I've actually been there, been in where Alan Turing's office was, in Hut 8 where they did the code breaking. You know, I've actually been into the mansion and walked around the grounds. And so when I, you know, read about it now, or, you know, if you see it on a movie, like if you watch The Imitation Game again and things like that, it's like, you know, I've actually been there. So it sinks in a bit more, I think.
It's like adding technicolor to your imagination, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it's another filter that I've got. Be good to enhance future learnings.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Can I have your attention for a few moments? For those who don't know me, Ian Sanders, I'm the Chief Executive of the Bletchley Park Trust. My pleasure to welcome you back here, in many cases, to Bletchley Park for our annual Veterans Reunion Day. I'm going to run through very briefly a bit about what we're doing now, what's in progress, and what the future holds. I'll start off by just reminding you that today, Bletchley Park is run by the Bletchley Park Trust as a museum and heritage site. That's what we do, and we preserve the memory of what went on in this fantastic place during the Second World War. As a result, we are 95% funded by the people who walk through the front doors. So it's great for me when I see those visitor numbers continue to increase. 4 years ago, we had 120,000 visitors a year. This year to date, we've had 210,000 visitors, which is quite fantastic. Both in terms of course, running the business, keeping it going and allowing us to do more stuff, but also indeed in terms of spreading the story ever wider. All parts of the world come here and the international renown of Bletchley Park continues. One of the big things we continue to push this year, I think at the moment we're 200 plus oral interviews. I'm just looking around at some of the badges, making sure you've all been got. You've got a red sticker, you've already been got, you've got a green, you said you're. Yeah, some of you many times, I know, serial offenders here. It's very important that we continue to capture your memories and your recollections, and this programme is really moving forward at quite a pace at the moment. I have a great team of people who go out to your houses and do interviews, and it's a great resource for us now to put quotes in exhibitions, bits of films on the multimedia guide and what have you. So thank you for taking part in this. If you've got a green sticker on, we'll come and get you soon. And if you haven't got any sticker, can we make sure we do capture you and your recollection? So that's sort of where we've done and what we've done to date. Up and coming at the moment, we've got a number of exhibitions in preparation. Some of you may have picked up from the BBC, there's a documentary running about Gordon Welshman next Monday, and we have an exhibition opening on Tuesday linking to that, which is the story of Gordon Welshman, to link into that again, so people who've seen the documentary can come and get a bit more on site. We're also going to be, in the next 6 months or so, an exhibition at HMS Petard, which is going to go back into Hut 8. Some of you remember we did have a very rudimentary one in there, we're going to have a better exhibition in there. When the Imitation Game exhibition closes down in November, we're going to turn over the ballroom to Social Stories. So we've got some of those on the top floor of Block B. We'll expand those and talk about sort of social life around Bletchley Park in there. And finally, we've got a number of Y Service veterans in here. Be pleased to know that when the restoration exhibition finishes in Hut 12, we're then going to turn that over to a much bigger Y Service exhibition. So lots of things to look forward to. All those are pretty much planned and funded. What I'm now going to talk about is the long-term plans. So first of all, Hut 4, our rather tired and old canteen. Of course, it's a wartime building, so we want to keep the building. We want to take the cafe out of there. We're going to use Hut 4 to be a more family-focused setting. Moving on round, the garage is at the back of the mansion, much like many stately homes do with their stables. We'll be turning those into our cafe facility for our visitors. Then moving on to the stable yard, which is full of our trust offices at the moment. We want to get the offices out of those and into the stable yards. Hut 11A is now restored as a building, but it's an empty shell at the moment, and we're busy fundraising and planning an exhibition. It talks about the bomb, from concept with the Polish bomber, how it was developed, and what it actually did to farming process. The building you're in, the Teller Printer Hall, the actual plan is to tell the story of the impact of Bletchley Park. Most of the stuff we tell at the moment is about the process, about the code breaking, about the things that went on in that process. Actually, what we don't tell very well is how important it was that the intelligence produced here, what the impact of intelligence was. And principally, it's going to use D-Day as the vehicle to do that. As you well know, D-Day is like a sort of pinnacle of Bletchley Park. Coming together of all those things, just bringing together that whole great huge intelligence picture that allowed the Allies to do so well at D-Day. So that's what it's going to be. The go-to place on Bletchley. You come here and you really get that sort of feeling of why Bletchley is so important. Hello. And finally, then the big buildings behind here, Block E and Block A. Some years ago, those were leased out as office accommodation. It made sense to the trust at the time to get an income stream from those. Now that income stream is very small, and actually much more importantly, we want to take those buildings back and use them as part of our museum. Mm-hmm. So when we take them back at the end of the lease, Block E will become bottom floor, archive, storage, and the top floor will be our new education centre. This year, we'll host about 17,000 children on our education programme, and we aspire to get to 25,000. Why do we aspire to get to 25,000? Because we're oversubscribed. We'll deal with 17,000, there's still people waiting to come. And the reason we're such a good and such an in-demand education programme is we fill a gap in the national curriculum. What the kids come and do here is based around code-breaking, which is essentially maths by stealth. And then Block A, we turned over the bottom floor to more museum space to to allow us to tell more and more stories, and the top floor will be where the trust offices relocate. And when we've done all that, we will be largely complete in terms of the heritage side of the site here. But as I said, this is a 10-year plan. There's lots of planning to go on, lots of work, lots of fundraising. Thank you very much for coming. Do come back for next year. Do enjoy the rest of your time here. And thank you.
Hello there. You having a nice day?
Yes, yes, thank you.
Hello.
How are you then?
I'm very well. Sarah, this is Pat. This
is hello, Pat.
Sarah. Hello, Sarah.
Lovely to meet you.
Well,
how are you?
Lovely to meet you, yes. What a nice day. I've never been to one of these before. So. I'm very glad about the Y Station's hut.
Yeah. How was Edinburgh?
Oh, great. We had over 300 people, which was nice. And they're a very nice audience. And they all stood up and applauded at the end. Because Tessa Dunlop interviewed Ruth Bourne and Betty Webb and my sister and me about exploits. That was great. And we enjoyed ourselves. And then Tessa and I think Ruth and I are going to do the Cheltenham Book Festival.
Oh, brilliant.
In October.
Wow.
So it goes on.
What are you doing now? You're going to get something to eat?
I'm due on a veterans tour.
So shall we walk you over there?
Yes. I don't have to do it, but I think I can.
Bartram Robinson. And I've been for quite a few years. The place now is immaculate, isn't it?
It is. It's really picked up. I haven't been for quite a few months now, and I've noticed how much lovelier it looks and how much more welcoming it is.
Yeah. And over this Veterans Day, they've turned the volunteers out in great numbers, haven't they? And
they have, yes.
I've really, you know, set it out. This is the first time I've been here to Veterans Do, but... they've been doing it for some years, haven't they?
Yeah, they've been doing it for quite a few years. Mm. So this is your first time here?
Yeah. I've been here, not as a veteran, but, you know... No, I've been to a veterans reunion at the Victory Club in London two or three times, but very small, 20-something like that.
Yeah.
And there's only one person I knew of what I was with, and all the rest, and they band together, Radio Hams, you see.
They
all came to this reunion with they got a yellow jersey with their call sign emblazoned on their chest, as it were.
Wow.
And, of course, they kept talking to one another, shop, of course, and I did sit next to a civilian, because I was Corps of Signals, who worked there in later years at Hanslope, and he taught, not that sort of shop, to me, because we were engineers. But when you think about it, there was less than about 150 of us there, engineers, and there was 10,000 here at Bletchley Park, so the chances of me finding somebody from Hanslope Park are very, very slim now, but I'll try it.
So what did you do? You were an engineer?
I was an engineer at Hanslope, yeah. We worked 12 days and then had 2 days off. We built what became the successor to Typex, which was RockX. They don't show one here.
No.
RockX was in use till the 80s.
Oh, right, so that recent.
Yeah, yeah. And they've got one at the Signals Museum at Blandford. I saw that about a couple of weeks ago. I was down that way. And, it wasn't very portable at all. And, of course, it's all clad in sheet metal. You can't see the rotors. And, of course, it had valves.
Yeah.
About 20 valves on it. I was on electrical assembly. I was wiring them up. That's what I was doing. But we were kept very separate from all the other workshops. I looked through the window next to me, and over the passage was the tool room. And I knew two of the chaps in the tool room were in my hut, but I couldn't go in the tool room and talk to them. You weren't
No,
you were kept very, you know, compartmentalised, as it were. They were there. And the operators, their huts were some distance from our huts, because the interceptor station was across the fields, and didn't see much of them. And of course, they were men from 18 to about 55. Yeah, the thing they had in common, really, was that they could read Morse at a terrific rate.
Yeah.
But no, they were a lot on their own, as it were. Funnily enough, the commandant of the camp who was an old signals man. He must have been a reservist. He lived within 4 or 5 miles of where I lived now. I mean, he's been dead years. And so when I was demobbed and went back home, I was in a shop in Bishop's Stortford, tap on the shoulder, and, hello, my boy. How are you doing in Civvy Street? I mean, he wasn't a technical man, so he didn't come around the workshops. He might have seen me half a dozen times, but obviously there wasn't that great number, and I suppose he recognised a face, I suppose. Funny how things happen like that.
Some people are gifted that way, aren't they, with the facial recognition?
Exactly, yes, yeah. They are. The other person who worked here, I found out later, we've got a funeral business, and I was talking to the receptionist, Nan. I said, you know, you're getting on a bit. Where were you in? I was at Bletchley Park. I said, Nan, what were you doing there? I was a receptionist. So I said, did you receive all the red forms that the dispatch riders came from the outstations? Like, Hansen? Oh, yes, she said, I dished them out to the huts. What a small world, work for us, you know? And she lost her, he was a post office engineer, and I expect that's how, in a way, she got here.
And what was her name?
Her name was Nan Granger. Then when he died, she moved out to Vancouver.
Wow, yeah.
And she died out there, yeah. But I'm hoping I'm going to see somebody. I look at some of these old chaps, I wonder, you know, are you? And then you see the badge. But I am in touch with a 98-year-old. I mean, I'm 91 and a half. And he came to Hanslope in our workshop, and he'd been drafted down from the Glasgow shipyards, where he was sent by the Ministry of Labour, because he was a Yorkshireman. He was sent there to look after the telegraphy material on the destroyers on the North Atlantic. And he came there, and of course he was 7 years, or well, nearly 8 years older than me.
Yeah.
And at that age, that's old, you know. If you're 20, and he's 28, you know, as it were. So I didn't get to know him very well, but in a magazine I saw this Sid Petch, and we had a Sid Petch in our workshop. I got hold of him, and I spoke to him last year. Frinton-on-Sea, he lived in a bungalow with his wife.
Yeah.
So I said to him, Sid, you remember me, Robbo, from Hanslope Park? Oh, yes, he said. Oh, yeah, you're in the workshop. That's right. So that was last year, and my wife, at the end of the year, she died, and
I'm so sorry.
I couldn't keep in touch. Well, this year, earlier on, I got in, or tried to get in touch again. He's in the home now. His wife fields all the telephone messages.
Yeah.
Because she knows that he can't answer. But I still know he's there, and I still know he's alive. And how he got to Bletchley, I don't know, because at Hanslope, we were all demobbed together, and we had to sign on 6 months as a civilian working for one of the MIs, 5 or 6, until our number came up, or for 6 months, whichever was the shortest. Well, the whole engineering section was moved down to Wembley. I'd left by then.
Well, it's very nice to have met you, and thank you very much for your service.
All right.
And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day, whatever you get up to.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. And do you like to be Florence or Flo?
Flo.
Flo.
Everyone call me Flo.
I'm sat here now with Flo Cole, who was a WAF, and I see from your badge you were at Chicksands. When did you join up, or were you called up?
1943, but I was called up.
Did you pick the WAF?
Well, it was a bit difficult at the time because I'd got two brothers in the RAF, which were called up, and I was very upset when I had to go to be registered, and all they could offer me was to be in the army. Oh, dear, I thought. Strangely enough, I just said, oh, I can't go in the army. My brothers are in the Air Force. So this particular person that was interviewing me, she said, well, I'm sorry, you've got to go in the army. I said, I'm sorry, hang on, I've got to go home and ask my mother whether... And when I got home, my mother said, definitely not the army. You've got to go and follow your brothers.
Well, your brothers wouldn't have let you live it down, would they?
Oh, dear. I was really scared.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, my gosh, if I don't do this. So I said to my mother, could you come with me? Because I was scared. She said, oh, don't be silly. Just go back and tell them your mother has told me to tell you that you can't go in the army. And I went back and she said, oh, it's you again? And I said, yes. I said, you better change pretty quick. I'm not going in the army. I've got to go. My mother's told me. I can always remember. Anyway, the outcome of it all is I did go in the Air Force. But it was fun in those days.
So did you have basic training first?
Oh, yes. I went to Inchworth Lane in Gloucester, did my initial training, and it was one of the hottest summers you could imagine in 1943. I can always remember I was kitted out with full gas equipment on the parade ground, one of the hottest days we'd had for months, and I could feel myself just going over, thinking, landed on the floor, and all I could hear in the distance was, pick that woman up. It was really fun, but serious.
Yeah. And what age were you then? 17, half, 18?
No, I was 20.
Oh, 20.
Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to 617 Squadron, the Dambusters. Yes. Admin.
Yeah.
And it was sad, really, because I went in the August of 43, and, of course, Guy Gibson and all his... a lot of them were killed.
Yeah.
Well, 55,000 to date.
From Bomber Command, yes.
But I didn't stay there very long, but it was interesting, really interesting. And I stayed in the dearest little village in Lincoln called Dunholme Lodge. It was a sweet little place, but I wasn't there that long. Then I left there, went on the course at Cranwell, and I passed out there, and there I am at Chicksands Priory as a codebreaker.
Were you specifically interviewed to do that course, or did they pick you out?
Yes, but it was a slow process, you see, because I'd passed my initial part of being a codebreaker. Then when I got on, I was in a position where I'd come through it all, and I was then ready to take on Chicksands Priory because I'd got through my exams, you see.
Yeah.
And I'd be, yes, because I ended up there.
So when you got to Chicksands, what was the work you were doing at Chicksands?
Well, all the messages came in from the wireless telegraphists in code. We typed in code, sent it to, well, the courier used to be there, to take it all to Bletchley Park here. I was a telepeter operator, yes.
That's what I wanted to know. I mean, did you know when you went in to start doing those courses what it would lead to? No.
It's awfully difficult. I've tried so hard over the years to try and impose what I feel then and still remember we were living in another world. Mm. Really and truly, I find it difficult.
I don't think people today understand how all-encompassing that war was, not just for people serving, but for people at home, on the home front. Everyone was involved, weren't they?
But when I went home on leave, my mother never asked me what I did, and I never told her.
Hush, hush.
It was very strange, because you'd have thought one of the family would have said, well, what were you doing? No, never.
To this day, I've still not heard a veteran say one of their family members, apart from saying, oh, what are you doing? The first time, maybe, and the veteran say, I can't tell you.
It's strange.
It was a different attitude, wasn't it?
It's a different world. And we live for the day. We never thought of tomorrow.
No.
That was the time we were living in. And it was a really slow process. We weren't going, although I went from place to place, but it wasn't rushing here, there and everywhere. It was, once again, I find it difficult to express myself. But all I can say is, totally different world. And then when I went home on leave, and I'm Birmingham born, we were right by the BSA Canal.
Mm.
We lived not far, half a mile. And then when I went home on leave, the bombing was terrible. I put up with all that and thinking I was going to have it a bit quiet. But no, it was still more so being among all the bombing. But it was accepted because we were at war. And also, in the war, this might not be of interest to you, but we used to have chandelier bombs. They were like a chandelier. One evening, I was home on leave, and we had to go in this shelter in the garden. And there were 12 in that particular shelter. Mm. And one of these bombs, a 13-gallon oil bomb, fell at the back of the 3 shelters. And it was frightening because we were stuck there, and finally the bomb disposal men came, and we went, the nearest place to keep us safe was where the nuns were, which was only about 10-minute walk, and we went down in this crypt, all of us. Yes, and they fed us, and the very next night it was bombed to the ground. So, do you call that luck?
I think you're very lucky.
I think we were.
But I suppose going home and seeing that, because a lot of veterans we have felt at the time, you know, they couldn't see what they were doing, how that was helping the war.
That's very true.
But, you know, you could go home, see that that bombing was happening and know that you were doing something that was was helping.
But when I think back now, it must have been very important. But I've always thought it wasn't.
That's the thing. All of you are so modest.
Well, all these years, I've always felt, yes, I did that. But I've never considered myself important enough to talk and say, I did this or I did that. No, I've been very quiet about it for the last 70 years.
So many of you have.
Mm.
That's the reason why people now are so in awe of our veterans, because they can't believe that you could do that for 70 years. And every single one of you was important. Every single one of you was a tiny cog in this big machine. From the most famous code breaker down to the tea girl, everyone was important.
I suppose you're right, but I've never felt I was very special or anything like that, because, you know, I don't know. It's just part of the way I feel about it all.
You're all so similar. I haven't heard one bragging veteran ever. You're all so modest.
What a strange thing.
And all I can say is thank you for your service.
Oh, how kind of you to say that. I can look back now and feel, yes, maybe we did contribute a little bit.
Well, you definitely did. And
thank you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.